This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The publicity drumroll over the weekend would put a Roman cavalcade to shame. Judas, disciple and biblical betrayer of Jesus, is on America's media screen like never before. The National Geographic cable channel is putting the big trumpet to news of the discovery and translation of a long-lost Gospel of Judas. But if the marketing is over the top, what if the most hated man in history was a hero? The scholarly and theological issues raised by the ancient papyrus are very real. Conservatives, fresh from the Da Vinci Code battles, are fighting back, and the boundaries of the Bible are being questioned again. Up next on Point, new Gospels, Judas, Jesus, history, and faith. In this hour, we'll talk with three religious scholars about the Gospel of Judas. One is a translator of the new Gospel. Another is a Harvard Divinity School professor who focuses on Gnostic texts. And another is a leading evangelical academic. I want to turn first to Marvin Meyer, who joins me in the studio. He's professor of Bible and Christian Studies and co-chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Chapman University in Orange, California, author of numerous books, including the Gnostic Gospels of Jesus. He is one of the translators of the Gospel of Judas. Marvin Meyer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So here you were, working directly with this papyrus document crumbled into 1,000 or more pieces, mm-hmm. reassembled very painstakingly, this whole dramatic story laid out hyper-dramatically by mm-hmm. National Geographic of it being found and stuck in a safe deposit box in Hicksville, New York, and offered for sale and not sold and offered for sale and sold and finally now out with the sort of mega media treatment on the National Geographic cable channel. Describe for us the first time you saw this document and the expertise you brought to it and what you saw when you looked into its text.
Well, it was indeed a great honor to be able to face this text and to do something with the text. I think this is just a delightful moment, a moment where we can take a look at a text that has been lost for a long time, a text that was on the verge of being lost again, that was turning into fragments. It has been snatched out of the prospects of falling into oblivion and now has been reassembled with fragments that are put back together and so on by some of the best folks in the world. So it really has been a marvelous kind of opportunity and a wonderful chance to take a look at this piece of our religious and historical tradition.
Describe the language it's written in and the expertise you brought to that language.
Well, the text is written in Coptic, which is a form of the Egyptian language that was used during the Roman period and thereafter. The language is still with us today. It functions as a liturgical language in the Coptic Orthodox Church and is also being revivified as a language that is sometimes spoken and people are writing poetry in Coptic and so on. But the text itself, we are convinced, was composed not in Coptic, but rather in Greek. All of the evidence inside the text would point to that. It was composed in Greek in the middle of, somewhere around the middle of the second century of the Common Era, and then subsequently translated into Coptic. We have no evidence at this point of any Greek fragments that survive of the Gospel of Judas. Presumably, most of those copies of the Gospel of Judas have been destroyed or have rotted away with rain that has fallen throughout parts of the Mediterranean, but those wonderful dry sands of Egypt have preserved a Coptic translation of Judas.
We've seen, many people have now seen the images of this document, and it was papyrus literally crumbling into dust in
Absolutely.
Tiny fragments,
yes.
painstakingly reassembled to the extent possible in Switzerland.
Yes.
As a translator, you're looking at lots of incomplete sentences here where things are dropped out. There's holes in here. But I wish you'd take us to the kind of the core lines in this document that have turned people's heads that may be seen as recasting our understanding of the relationship of Jesus and Judas.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a number of lines, I suppose, that turn heads, and it depends on which heads we're talking about that are turned by different lines. But for the popular audience, I suppose, it is this rather different presentation of Judas that catches the attention of many people. The fact that he is presented not as a disciple on the outside, somebody who is the quintessential traitor, who is infamous for the Judas kiss, but rather the disciple who is most clearly on the inside, the one who truly knows Jesus and understands Jesus, who listens to the revelation of Jesus in this text, believes it, and is transfigured as a result.
Take us to the specific lines that give us that portrayal.
Well, there are, in fact, a couple of lines, I suppose, that are especially interesting. Early on in the text, Judas is the one who offers what is taken to be the basic kind of a profession of faith. The other disciples don't get it. The other disciples don't understand who Jesus is, but Judas does. And he says, when the other disciples can't stand before Jesus, they can't stand up in his presence, and Judas can, and he turns his eyes downward in a rather humble kind of way, but yet stands before Jesus and says, I know who you are and where you have come from. You are from the immortal realm of Barbalo, and I am not worthy to utter the name of the one who has sent you. And that kind of language about the immortal realm of Barbalo, or the aeon of Barbalo, refers to the realm of the divine. You are from the realm of the divine, and I am not worthy to utter the name of the one who has sent you. That is the highest God who has sent Jesus into this world as one to reveal truth in this world.
There, what seems to be then a profession of a special kind of insight into Jesus' teachings. And then when it comes to the betrayal, Judas is portrayed here as, in a sense, following Jesus' orders. What's the money line on that? What's the
money line, the real zinger, you know, that finally concludes everything is this. Jesus has just explained the whole realm of God, how in the beginning there was an utterly transcendent deity, and through stages there is an extension of this deity finally down into this world, and through it all a divine essence, a divine spirit, a true humanity is communicated through those people and to those people of knowledge, and Jesus has that inside of him. Then he turns to Judas and he says, you will exceed all of them, that is, all the other disciples, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me. That is to say, the mortal flesh on the outside, which is passing away, will be gone. Mm. Judas will help Jesus rid himself of that mortal flesh. And the inner person, that is the real person of Jesus, and for that matter, that same inner person is the real person of Judas and of all people, it is suggested, then can be liberated and freed.
Marvin Meyer, one of the translators of this really remarkable document that's getting so much attention in the last few days, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation as well. Also with us in the studio, and we're delighted to have her, Karen King is here, professor of New Testament Studies and the History of Ancient Christianity at Harvard Divinity School, a specialist in Egyptian Coptic Gnostic text just like this one. Karen King, thanks so much for being here.
It's a very pleasure. Thank you.
Take us to the heart of the theological issues raised by this document. If Judas was doing Jesus a favor, was following Jesus' wish, Where does that put us in terms of theological interpretation or reinterpretation?
Well, there are two really important points that I think people will want to know about and that are going to be extremely controversial around this text.
And we'll hear that controversy in this hour, but please.
And the first of those is the question about the meaning of the crucifixion. Because rather than see the crucifixion and the resurrection as a complex of atonement Christology, that is to say, the dominant mode of understanding who Jesus was and why he was important, that Orthodoxy has carried on, that understands Jesus' death as a sacrifice for the sins of humanity to overcome it.
This is absolutely fundamental to traditional Christian belief.
It really became the center, especially when we have the Nicene Creed and so forth. By the 4th century, this becomes really central to early Christian theology. This text is part of the way that early Christians were thinking about, questioning, asking themselves, what does the death of Jesus mean? What are we supposed to do with it? And this text lets us see a different kind of point of view. It puts Jesus' teachings first and foremost, and it understands his death as showing the path back to God. Now, this is not this is actually not difficult for someone in antiquity, because the idea that the body at death is going to deteriorate, pass away, move back to the materiality out of which it came would have been the normal kind of view, and it is the soul that goes to God.
But this was defined as heresy by the early church. Is it still heresy today, Karen King?
Well, that's actually an extraordinarily interesting question, because Orthodoxy, if you're Orthodox Christian, if you are if you have right belief, you're supposed to understand not only that Jesus rose physically from the dead, but that you as a believer and all believers will rise physically from the dead. But actually, in fact, I think a lot of Christians really think of themselves as their bodies going to death and their souls going to God. That's closer to this text. So, yes, I think that the emphasis that you hear today is on the physical resurrection of Jesus. People talk less about their own resurrections, their own physical resurrections. This text is making it clear, the way I think it was for all early Christians, that what happens to Jesus is what happens to believers. So he is, at his death, released from the body, and Judas aids him in that.
Larry is calling from Boston. Hi, Larry, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. The thing that disturbs me about the Judas gospel is this. You know, over the last 2,000 years, millions of Jews have been killed in the Inquisition, the Crusades, the Holocaust, because a lot of people felt that with the Jews that, in quotes, killed Christ.
And that was often tagged back to Judas himself.
Yeah, also, I think maybe Mel Gibson should make a Passion of the Christ too, with the new revisions that are revealed in this Judas Gospel. So for 2,000 years, people under a misconception have led to being anti-Semitic and worse.
Do you see this new gospel as an exoneration, Larry? Do you see it as pulling some of that sting?
Exoneration. It just shows the idiocy of people who are fundamental and take the Bible or the gospel as the literal truth.
Let us pick it up. Of course, many people do. Karen King, you study it. Larry, thanks for your call. Of course, Judas has become the kind of center of focus, the face that's often inspired anti-Semitism over many, many centuries now. How did that develop, and does this gospel, should it affect that view in some way?
Well, it became very clear, especially in the medieval period, that the figure of Judas was identified as the Jew and was betrayed Jesus, and therefore that played into already extant kinds of a Christian anti-Semitism. Now, one might hope with this new view of Judas that would be a blow against that kind of Christian anti-Semitism. Unfortunately, the text is not going to help us.
Because?
And the reason is because it talks about inner Christian It rehabilitates Judas, but at the cost of the other 12 disciples. And they are portrayed as like the priests in the temple. Let me just quote you. It talks about these priests as people who sacrifice their own children, others their wives, in praise and humility with each other. Some sleep with men. Some are involved in slaughter. Some commit a multitude of sins and deeds of lawlessness.
We've got a whole new raft of stuff here.
So what we have is a very sharp and uncompromising kind of Christian anti-Judaism in this text. And so the rehabilitation of Judas is only going to take us so far. And that's the line that we have to hold against this kind of Christian anti-Judaism.
Mm-hmm. Marvin Meyer, how do you see it? Are we taking the one who got so much pinned on him, who Dante put in the lowest level of hell, being eaten headfirst by Beelzebub? Mm-hmm. Are we going to exonerate the one and put 11 more in jeopardy?
Karen raises some very interesting points, and to be sure, we haven't talked about this, but there's some material in this text that is highly incorrect in terms of its political correctness. This is a polemical text seen in the context of other polemical texts that come out of the same period of time. Early Christians were not kind and gentle with each other if they disagreed. Often they accused each other of all kinds of unseemly behavior, and it could become pretty ugly indeed. So what Karen says is exactly right about the text. There is plenty of that kind of material. At the same time, I guess my hope is that readdressing the figure of Judas and looking again at Judas could have some kind of impact. I hope that there are, in fact, Jewish and Christian thinkers who come together to assess this text, that look at this text in the context of the other text, say the New Testament text, and see that not only is there in this text a a reaffirmation of the figure of Judas as being a positive figure, but that the role of Judas in this text has some parallels in some of the hints that are seen already in the New Testament. Because already there, if you look beyond the editing that went on that accused him as being the evil Jewish person who turned in his master, it seems to be the case that behind all of that, there is the admission already in the New Testament that Judas was a part of the circle of the 12 and a very important part of that circle.
Clearly.
That he was a close friend of Jesus. Mm. In fact, part of the poignant quality of that story in the New Testament is that Jesus got turned in by one of his best friends. Mm. The motive is not always clear, but that's a powerful story. Now, if it does look as if Judas is capable of some rehabilitation in the discussion, then what does that all mean? I would hope we can put all the texts on the table and reexamine them. And if it's possible to obliterate one of the building blocks of anti-Semitism, I would hope that would have some kind of impact on our awareness of our need and our hope to be generous and loving with each other.
Questions, big questions here of history, questions that go to theology, certainly to issues of anti-Semitism. And Karen King, as you point out, a lot of controversy here as well about exactly how much this means and how seriously practicing Christians should be taking what they're reading in this new gospel. Karen King, Marvin Meyer, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Wilmore, Kentucky, Ben Witherington. He's one of the top evangelical Christian scholars in the world, professor of New Testament interpretation at Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. He's written over 30 books, including The Jesus Quest. His blog, widely visited, is benwitherington.com. Ben, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
You are looking at this new Gospel of Judas and saying that it's pinning your baloney meter. Why?
Well, if you're interested in church history from the late 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, then this is a document that's of some importance. But it tells us absolutely nothing about the historical Jesus or the historical Judas at all. We don't have any reason to think that this document existed before the late 2nd century AD. And I'm dubious about claims that there are a Greek original. There's no physical evidence of that. So, I mean, we could debate that. But my greater concern is this, that this gospel has no right to stand toe-to-toe with Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, which have a pedigree to have been written in the 1st century AD, or maybe at the very end if we're talking about the Gospel of John. This is a document that reflects the Gnostic split-off movement, which began in the middle of the 2nd century AD and continued on for a considerable period of time. And it tells us about their particular brand of split-off theology, which is very dualistic. It's anti-Semitic. It's not feminist-friendly in various ways. And so I don't really think that this document's going to much help with modern issues of political correctness, and I certainly don't think it's going to tell us anything new about the historical Jesus or the historical Judas. I was talking to Professor A.J. Levine yesterday, who was involved in the process with this document towards the end, and I just asked her straight out, well, do we learn anything new about the historical Jesus or the historical Judas from this document? And she said, absolutely not. We certainly do not, because this document has no claims whatsoever to be a first-century document or by an eyewitness. It's a pseudonymous document. It's a document with a falsely attributed author.
Let me ask you, Ben Witherington, I mean, it does go way back, all the way in the year 180. You've got Irenaeus saying, this Gospel of Judas, which we knew he said this, but hadn't read the Gospel, this is out. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are in. That puts it back pretty early, it would suggest. How does its date of origin, what do we know about how it compares to the four Gospels in the New Testament of the Bible?
Well, all of them date to the 1st century A.D. I mean, I've actually held a piece of the Gospel of John that dates, a piece of papyrus that dates to 125 A.D. We know that the canonical Gospels were written in the New Testament era itself, the 1st century of the Common Era. We have no evidence. It's an argument from silence altogether to suggest this document goes back to the 1st century A.D.
Karen King, speak to this. You and other scholars are taking this very seriously, saying that it reflects in a very important way on on early Christian belief. Ben Witherington says, come on, this is second tier. This comes after the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This is a settled issue. This, you know, watch out. There's baloney here, and it doesn't tell us anything new.
Yeah, there are two things I would say about that. First of all, is that I would agree with Ben, okay? That if we want
on
to,
which?
If we want to write a portrait of the historical Jesus, our best texts are going to be the New Testament Gospels and probably the Gospel of Thomas as well.
The best because they're the earliest?
Yes, because they're the earliest, and dating doesn't always mean that earliest is the best historical information. But in this case, I think we're on solid ground in saying that those texts, especially Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Gospel of Thomas, work.
And help us understand, just so we can apply our own minds to this, those were written how long after the crucifixion of Jesus?
30 to 60 years.
And do we have any idea how long after this Judas document was written?
About 120.
Okay.
So those are estimates.
Okay. Uh-huh. So you say look first to the four that are in the Bible. You agree with Irenaeus and Ben Worthington?
Well, no. Yes and no. The two places that I would make some exception is the notion that the way people read the New Testament is to see it as in a literal way as historically accurate. What we need to do is we need to realize that both the New Testament Gospels and these later Gospels are all the voices of early Christians. What we don't have is the direct voice of Jesus. He didn't write anything. So what we're seeing is first century views of Jesus and second century views of Jesus. And so we need to always understand that we're hearing Christian voices talking about the meaning of who Jesus was. All those texts, including the New Testament texts, come to us highly interpreted theologically. And the second point that goes along with this is that these texts help us read the New Testament texts fresh. Now, what do I mean by that? Those texts, the New Testament has had 2,000 years of steady interpretation. We think we're reading them when we sit down, but the Gospel of Mary gives us a good example. I was raised thinking that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. And now we know, and the Catholic Church agrees, everyone agrees, that there's not a shred of evidence in the New Testament supporting this view of Mary Magdalene as a prostitute. My question is, why has nobody noticed that for 1,500 years? Why are people who are reading their Bibles not noticing it? And I want to suggest that it's because we already know she is. So we read the text.
We know
the
as
Testament.
If we've learned, sort of soaked it up by osmosis.
Exactly, from art and from literature and from preaching and so forth. And so when we read Mary in the New Testament text, we go, ah, the prostitute. What these texts let us see is something new. And with Judas, it's going to, I hope, make people go back to those texts and say, well, how is he portrayed? And here, Marv's point of view about Judas is really pertinent.
Marva Meyer, let me ask you. Ben Witherington essentially says, look, this came from Gnostic spin-off movement out in the boondocks of Egypt. They had their own dualistic tradition. This is out of step with the core, original, canonical Gospels, and don't make too much of it.
Well, I think that Ben would probably agree with this, too. I do want to make quite a bit of it, and I do want to make quite a bit of church history. I don't think that things ended at the end of the first century or when the last scribe of the Gospel of John put down the quill. That isn't the end of things. That's just a part of a very dynamic and vital and very diverse movement.
But do scriptures, Gospels written a century earlier, that much closer to the life of this figure, have greater historical authenticity to your mind?
Well, Karen's point is very significant, and that is all of the Gospels that we have are heavily edited. They all have a point of view. They all have a perspective. They all have their own theology. Part of the richness of early Christianity is the diversity that we can see there. And what is so precious about this particular text is it gives us a rather early, not a first century, to be sure, a mid-second century vision of one aspect of that diversity. Here we can see how some other Christians who were very sincere in their belief about how to follow Jesus understood their own Christianity and their own life. And so then to have that chance to see their perspective and then to see other perspectives simply gives us a much better perspective in our own way of all of the differences and the nuances of belief in the early church.
I want to keep our listeners here. So many of them want to join. Jefferson is calling from Las Vegas. Hi, Jefferson. You're on the air.
Good morning. Okay, this is what I'm hearing. I think that some people want to have it both ways. They want to say, well, Christ had to be crucified for everyone's sins to be taken care of, but they don't want anyone to have to be the bad guy and turn him in. So this that's being revealed seems like it's the way that Judas should always have been looked at, as he was a cog in the wheel of that big process. If they want to believe that he had to die, someone had to hand him over.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had the hardest job of all the apostles. Maybe he really got the short end of the stick, or the dipping of the bread at that Last Supper. Maybe Judas was screwed.
Well, he clearly has not done well. Jefferson, thanks for your call. Ben Witherington, what about it? This gets to some fairly core theological issues.
Yeah.
Whether Judas was part of the plan, and therefore it would not be right to demonize this man, or whether he was outside the plan, and how could that be if God is all-powerful?
Well, you're asking both historical and theological questions.
Yes.
I would say that compared to medieval anti-Semitism, the Gospels are pretty tame in what they say about Judas. And if we're looking at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when I'm referring mm-hmm. to the Gospels, that's what I'm talking
Understood.
About. Our earliest sources. Certainly he's said to be the one who betrayed Jesus. We actually have even earlier evidence in Paul. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul says, on the night in which Jesus was betrayed, this is a document written within 25 years of the death of Jesus. So we have a clear tradition that there was a disciple who betrayed or handed over Jesus to the authorities. And all of the canonical Gospels, of course, associate that act with Judas.
But was that God's will, or was that something demonic?
Well, it could be yes to both of those things. But the truth of the matter is, it seems to me, if we're going to look at it from a historian's point of view,
mm-hmm.
it looks to me like Judas was disillusioned, if we're going to present a mundane response. He was hoping, on the basis perhaps of the riding into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday with mm-hmm. great acclamation and the cleansing of the temple, he may have been a zealotic kind of follower of Jesus who thought, oh good, we're taking over now. There's 700,000 Jews here for the festival of Passover. We're going to kick the Romans out of town. Jesus is going to lead the way.
Mm-hmm.
He's our messianic figure. And then you get to the Last Supper, and Jesus says, no, it's not about killing. It's about me dying. And if you were a zealot Jew who thought by violent means it was necessary to retake the land, then you could be very easily disillusioned and wanting to go and hand Jesus over as a pretender rather than a messianic figure.
And, of course, this just the opposite of the interpretation we're hearing out of this Judas gospel of him being the closest to Jesus. Trevor's calling from West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Trevor. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you think, Trevor?
I think that it's an incredible find, and what I wonder is, who has the motive for destroying the original texts?
Destroying them? Are you
theological motive.
Do you assume that they were destroyed?
It sounds like it to me. This one document found in a safe deposit box in New York,
well, of course,
thousands of years later.
Well, we leave out the little step there of it being found in a cave in mm-hmm. Egypt. But Marvin Myers, speak to this. Ben Witherington says, look, there's no Greek text found here. We amazingly, after all these centuries, find a Coptic text. Do you assume there were others? Do you assume, like Trevor, that there was some effort to destroy these, or is it just our good fortune after so long to have this here to read?
Well, this is a very interesting comment and a very good question. The issue about whether there is a Greek original, of course, we don't have any papyrus fragment with Greek on that comes indisputably from the Gospel of Judas. We don't have a Greek original. But every evidence that can be found from the Coptic translation would suggest that this, in fact, was not composed in Coptic at all, but rather it goes back to a Greek original. The Greek loan words, we talked before about what it means to betray Jesus. Well, there is a particular word that is used in Greek in the New Testament and, mm-hmm. and elsewhere, paradidomi. It can mean betray. It can equally mean, and it really fundamentally means, to hand over. And the very choice of translation, betray or hand over, says something theologically and historically. Well, that's the very word that is used,
in fact, as a
Greek loan word in the Coptic Gospel of Judas. There's plenty of Greek there to point back to the high likelihood of a Greek original.
And what about the existence of this single copy? The fact that it does exist, does that say to you that other copies were rooted out and destroyed, or, on the contrary, over all this time, one survived that they were not, or does it say anything?
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact of the matter is we don't know anything about the numbers of texts that were around. We do know that papyrus and parchment was valuable. There were copies that were made, multiple copies of certain texts. We also know that that if a text didn't make the cut and wasn't being used by the emerging Orthodox Church and didn't finally find its way into the canon, then it would not likely be copied over in the same way. Some texts, in fact, apparently the texts of the Nag Hammadi Library, were buried away and were hidden away in a jar and buried in the sand close to the Jebel Tarif in southern Egypt.
Were those now found as well?
And they were found some years ago, as a matter of fact. So we speculate that once upon a time there were copies, as a matter of fact, and had a text like this been used more widely by folks like Irenaeus and others, there may have been more copies made too. But we are simply fortunate that one copy has survived.
Of course, what wisdom was in the time of Irenaeus, 180 or so, highly debated here. Many would say, I mean, Ben Witherington, I assume, would say he was right to make the cut he made. Let's hear from our listeners again. Bill's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm disappointed that your speaker did not talk about what happened to the Gnostic Christians when organized Christianity took over. They were literally persecuted out of existence. However, let me get back to the Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and even Thomas' earliest text point. Yes, they were the earliest documents, but they are not history in the true sense of the word. There's no historical evidence to show that they were written by the original eyewitnesses, and all sorts of evidence to show that they were not written by the original eyewitnesses.
And what's the significance of that to you, Bill?
Well, the significance is that if you read Paul's letters, and if you read the Gnostic Gospels, if you read the New Testament, you'll find that they don't even agree with each other. Christianity, especially in its first couple hundred years, couldn't even agree with itself as to what exactly was the nature of Christianity. You had Christians, for example, in the time of Paul, who, yes, they agreed that Christ was an interesting figure, but he was not divine, in other words, God.
Is it surprising to you that it took time for a shared sense of, standard of belief to emerge? I mean, this was a pretty wild series of events here, not so easy to make sense of, would you say?
No ifs, ands, or buts about it. But if you listen to teachers Sunday school today, they tell you that, gee, Christianity came out whole right after Christ's death, and it was a pure form of Christianity, and there was no problems, and later on it marched on to conquer the world. It doesn't tell you about the persecutions and the killings within Christianity itself.
Bill, thanks very much for your call. Ben Witherington, let me turn to you here. There is a debate that goes on in theological quarters, and I can hear it with you and Karen and Marvin this morning about how much continuing interpretation is justified.
Well, let's get back to some of the points that the caller made. We do actually have evidence that our canonical Gospels were either written by or connected to eyewitnesses and the original apostolic witnesses. The Gospel of John is the clearest one, where we hear that this is the eyewitness testimony of somebody who had seen the crucifixion in person and had seen the risen Lord thereafter. So it's especially clear in John.
Let me just do a little fact check or opinion check with my guests here, Ben, as we go forward. Karen, I saw your jaw drop a little bit at that assertion. Do you agree that we have eyewitness authorship in the four Gospels?
No, I would say we do not.
So, listeners, there you see the debate. Ben, please go on.
Well, what I'm saying is I'm not suggesting that Luke and Mark were eyewitnesses of the life of Jesus. I'm saying that they were connected to those who are, and that's exactly what Luke says. He says, inasmuch as many have undertaken to give an account of the things that have happened among us, I, too, consulted the eyewitnesses and the original preachers of the word in order to give you, O noble Theophilus, the straight story about what happened. Now, it seems very clear to me that we are dealing with people who are in contact with the eyewitness when we're dealing with Mark and when we're dealing with Luke. And in the case of the Gospel of Matthew and John, we're dealing with materials of people who were in contact with eyewitnesses as well.
So go to this issue of the Gnostics and why their view of Christianity, as I hear you, Ben Witherington, is not worthy, or is, in Irenaeus's view, heretical. Why were they less worthy as interpreters of history and theology here than others?
Well, first of all, because they post-date the life of Jesus by a considerable period of time. Secondly, because in many of these texts, as Marvin has mentioned, I mean, it's profoundly anti-Semitic. The earliest followers of Jesus were Jews. Jesus was a Jew. The whole New Testament, with the possible exception of Luke Acts, was probably written by Jews, and Jews who were in touch with early Judaism. Now, there's an in-house debate in early Judaism about Jesus, and that's perfectly appropriate. The polemics that went on in the first generation were an in-house debate. When you're dealing with Gnostic texts, you're dealing with texts that reflect the dualism of the Greco-Roman world. They don't really reflect the views of the earliest Christians who believed in death and bodily resurrection. They are a later, secondary, or tertiary reaction to the Jewishness of the earliest Gospels. It seems very clear.
Karen King, join us here. Should it be only the interpretations of the Jews who were kind of at the geographic heart of this story and cultural heart of this story that inform Christianity today? Are the Gnostics kind of, were they heretics? Were they bringing in a different tradition and superimposing it on early Christianity, in your view?
Hindsight has led us to think that Christianity, as I think one of our callers suggested, was formed from the beginning. It was fixed, it was settled, and it was simply a matter of passing it on. The story tells us that the devil sowed heresy, in the divine wheat field, and the heresy is secondary and later. What history tells us, and here I would disagree with Ben somewhat, what history shows us is that Orthodoxy as we know it was really shaped in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries. In the 1st century, we had no New Testament. We had no early church. We had no hierarchical leadership of bishops. There was no creed that was standard. What we're seeing in these early centuries is precisely the story of the shaping of those, and there was a lot of controversy about that. And certainly at the center of this, one of those issues was, what is the relationship of Christianity to Judaism? As Christianity begins to part the ways, as you speak, from Judaism. How did that happen? And in what ways then did Christian anti-Semitism, which I think you can see Christian anti-Judaism very strongly in the Gospel of John. This is the place where they say, your father is of the devil to the Jews.
But we've got a battle here between students of the Bible, theologians, and we hear it right in this conversation about whether this is still a kind of live and active issue that should still be sort of pulled up and open to reinterpretation or not.
Well, the fact is that we have multiple denominations, multiple churches now. This notion that Christianity was ever a unified, uniform phenomenon is false. What we need to do, in my mind, is to read all of these texts, including the New Testament texts, as well as these newly discovered texts, critically in our appropriation of them, and take responsibility for what one is pulling out of tradition and calling the authoritative voice of Christianity.
Do they bolster faith or erode it?
They bolster faith if they allow people to really search the scriptures, to read them fresh, to read these new texts, and to take responsibility for the kind of Christianity that they practice. Mm.
Rebecca's calling from Olmstedville, New York. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
As a child, I grew up in a fundamentalist church, took the Bible very literally, and even back then, before I quite knew what I was doing, I wondered why, if the death of Jesus were foretold so much in the Old Testament, as I believe then, how it didn't seem fair that Judas was the person who did this, when this was an essential thing that had to be done. So the Gospel of Judas and all the other scholarship that's going on today has been an open window for me. It has liberated me and made my faith much deeper and my sense of Christianity much more profound.
So for you, it knits that world together. Rebecca, we appreciate your call. Let me get a call from Waynesboro, Georgia. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
The point I'd like to make, and it's kind of ironic, I haven't had the pleasure of being exposed to the Gospel of Judas that y'all keep talking about, but I'm listening on my way to work, and I couldn't help but think it was ironic that I have always assumed that Judas was doing what he was deemed to do, not that he betrayed Jesus, and that he was performing the role that he was born to play. And the same thing with Mary Magdalene. It never says in the text that she was a prostitute. It just goes from talking about a prostitute to talking about Mary Magdalene, and everybody assumed that she was a prostitute.
If you see things in this new light, do you perceive it as, I don't know are you Christian, David?
I am.
Are these a threat to your faith?
And it's funny because, I seem to have split from a lot of my friends and family in this, in that I believe that the Bible, as we know it today, somewhere along the line, someone decided what would go into what we refer to as the Bible and what would get left out. And it does not surprise me at all to find new texts that pertain to the period. And I don't understand why people have such a hard time incorporating that into what they already know and believe.
David, thank you very much for your call from Waynesboro. Ben Witherington, you can hear this kind of contest between the perspective that says, let's keep studying and learning, let's keep an open mind, incorporate what we see here, and others, perhaps yourself, who say, look, we've been through this, we know what the core is, and let's not stray from it. How do you see that?
Well, first of all, I'm a teacher, and I'm all for any kind of evidence that we can get on any historical subject related to the origins of Christianity. So I'm not for suppression of anything. But I would just simply say, I'd give the advice to this caller that I would give to many people that my grandmother gave me, which is don't be so open-minded that your brains fall out. I would say that all of these things need to be read critically. And if you're reading it from a historian's point of view, with the earliest and best evidence.
Marvin Meyer, does a new picture of Christianity emerge with the Gospel of Judas now out there, Thomas earlier, writing about Magdalene? Does a new picture of Christianity emerge? Does it, in your view, as a translator and student of religion, does it require some adjustment of Christian understanding of the religion itself, or does it simply amplify what's already there? Does it shove heresy in people's faces? Does it force re-examination or not?
I think that with the Gospel of Judas and with some of the other Gospels of Thomas and of Mary and Philip and Truth and so on, I think there are some new things that begin to emerge. I would hope, at least in my mind, what begins to emerge is a deep appreciation that in the beginning, and Karen has said the same thing, in the beginning there is diversity. From the very beginning, we see diversity. And this image, as comfortable as it might be, that we are a part of a tradition that always has been a narrow and linear tradition dealing with truth, and there have been attacks from the outside, from the heretics, but they have been fended off and the heretics have been eliminated. That may be comfortable theology, but that's bad history.
Does it strengthen or weaken a religion to open the doors to that kind of interpretation?
Well, I think that, of course, is another very good question. I would hope it, in fact, would strengthen our ability to be tolerant and to celebrate diversity and to see that in a given movement like the Christian movement, there really is a huge amount of vitality with different ways of understanding the good news of Jesus. And through that, there ought to be an easier way to embrace some of those ways and see that there may be equal applicability of those.
Ben Witherington, last word goes to you. Just got half a minute. Do you see Christianity with these new discoveries and their dissemination, do you see it changing? Or is this a passing media moment and Christianity will stay as Irenaeus would have had it in 180?
No, I don't see it having any great impact on Christianity one way or another. And if we're looking for a kinder, gentler Savior, we already have that in the Gospels themselves. It was Jesus, according to Luke, who said from the cross, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. If he could say that to his executioners, he could also say it to Judas. So we already have what we need in those earliest sources. And I would just add to that during this Holy Week season that I think that all of these things need to be examined and discussed. But what I would say at the end of the day is that the book of Acts got it right. It said that there was a unity at the beginning, even while there was some diversity in that unity, and that Peter and that Paul and that John and the earliest disciples and the eyewitnesses of the risen Jesus were at one about these things.
That will have to end it today. Ben Worthington, Karen King, Marvin Meyer, thanks to each of you for being with us. It's been a very interesting conversation.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.